Investiture of the Gods, Chapter 29.
So it starts with Xia himself sending a messenger.
Right. A Xiu general, Nan Gongqi, is sent off secretly to Kaozu, his mission.
Mm-hmm.
Find Changhehu and deliver this letter from Jian Xia.
And this letter, penned by Xia himself, it's the real weapon here, isn't it? It's aimed straight at Heihu's conscience.
And his reputation. It's rhetorically brilliant.
Yeah.
Xia basically argues, look, a real official guides his king properly, mm-hmm. make sure the people are okay.
And then contrasts that sharply with Huhu.
Brutally. He labels Huhu's actions as tolerating pure evil. The source material itself is ruthless about Huhu's crimes.
Yeah, it lists things like misleading the emperor, crushing the people. There's that phrase, gnawing bone and sucking marrow.
Exactly. Just horrible imagery. And evil accumulated like a mountain. It paints Huhu as this absolute monster who has to be dealt with.
That kind of extreme portrayal feels necessary for Xia's next move, right? Because
yes.
The pitch to Heihu isn't just about ethics. It's very, very practical.
It is. The aha moment, the thing that really seems to break Heihu's loyalty to his brother, is the threat to the whole family.
The survival angle.
Precisely. Xia appeals to Heihu's reputation for being, you know, decent. He says, basically, you can clean up the family name. Deal with your brother.
But if he refuses...
Then Xia warns him. The Kunlun flames, meaning the unstoppable force of the Xiu campaign, will burn everything down. Good, bad, doesn't matter. Everyone goes. The phrase is jade and stone without distinction.
Total annihilation. That's a powerful threat. More powerful, maybe, than just abstract justice.
Seems like it. The text says Heihu reads this letter over and over, maybe 3-5 times. You can feel the internal struggle.
And what tips the scale?
Posterity, it seems. He thinks, okay, offending my ancestors, that's terrible. A huge taboo. But being hated by the world for generations to come, that's worse.
So the calculation is reputation and the family's future over personal filial bonds.
It's chilling, but that's the choice he makes. And once he decides, he moves fast. He agrees to hand over his brother. But first, strategically, he leaves his own son, Chengning Gluan, to guard his base in Kaozu. Smart move.
Protecting his rear before walking into the lion's den? Okay, so he's resolved. But how does he actually trap Huhu? He can't just arrest him openly.
No, that would blow back immediately. He needs a believable scenario, a trap. And it requires some serious acting.
Tell me about the setup.
Heihu marches to Chongcheng, that's Huhu's territory, with his elite troops, the 3,000 flying tiger soldiers.
Okay.
He meets his nephew there, Chong Yingbiao, that's Huhu's son. And Yingbiao is actually relieved to see his uncle arrive with reinforcements.
Perfect cover. Instant trust and access.
Exactly. The stage is set.
Yeah.
And the performance begins almost immediately. Heihu meets Nan Gongxi, the Xu general who delivered the letter on the battlefield.
And they pretend to fight.
Yep. Stage duel. They go at it for about 20 rounds. The text even says Heihu secretly tells Nan Gongxi, this is just for show.
Uh-huh. And Nan Gongxi plays along.
Beautifully. He makes a big show of retreating, shouting something like, Heihu, he's too strong. I'm no match for him. It totally sells the deception to Yingbiao watching nearby.
Okay, but then there's that interesting moment where the nephew, Yingbiao, gets a little suspicious.
He does. He asks his uncle, hey, why didn't you use your famous weapon, the Divine Eagle? It's like Heihu's signature move.
Good question. How does Heihu handle that?
His answer is fascinating because it shows how much clout Jiang Xia already has. Heihu basically says, oh, Xia is a Kunlun mountain guest.
Meaning
he's like an immortal, someone with almost supernatural insight. Heihu implies Xia would have seen through any trickery, like him holding back his best weapon.
Wow. So Xia's reputation becomes part of the manipulation itself.
Exactly. It helps explain why Huhu's own family never saw the betrayal coming. They respected, maybe even feared, Xia's power.
Okay, so that quells the nephew's doubts. Now they need to lure the main target, Huhu himself.
Right. Heihu and Yingbiao collaborate on a letter back to Huhu, who's still in Zhao, the Shang capital. They basically scream, emergency.
Exaggerating the threat from the Xu forces.
Massively. They urgently request troops from King Xu, claiming they're about to be overrun.
And Huhu buys it.
Hook, line, and sinker. He's apparently furious with Wen Wang, the Xu leader, and totally trusts his brother and son. He gets 3,000 men from the king and rushes back to Chongcheng.
Walking right into the trap, thinking he's coming to save the day.
Believing he's riding towards a glorious victory, yeah.
So the stage is set inside Chongcheng for the final act. The ambush must have been planned meticulously.
Oh, down to the last detail. Speed was crucial. Heihu couldn't give Huhu time to think or react. He sets up his own men inside the city gate.
Do is involved.
He gets his deputy general, Gao Ding, to ready 20 axemen, Dou Fushu. These guys are basically the enforcers.
And the signal.
Incredibly simple. Dramatic, too. The sound of Heihu drawing his own sword. That's the cue.
He's also thinking about the whole family unit, isn't he? Not just Huhu.
Yes, very strategically. He orders another officer, Shen Gang, to simultaneously capture Huhu's wife, Li Shi, and their daughter.
And send them where?
Straight to the zoo camp. It ensures the entire immediate family is neutralized. No loose ends, no potential for future revenge plots.
So the moment arrives, Huhu approaches the city.
Heihu and his nephew Ying Biao ride out to meet him, about maybe a mile or so outside the walls. Very welcoming.
Lulling him into a false sense of security.
Completely. They escort him towards the city gates. As they pass through, Heihu draws his sword.
The signal.
And instantly, the axemen leap out, seize Huhu, and seize Ying Biao too. The nephew gets caught in the same net.
Wow. And when Huhu cries out, realizing he's been betrayed by his own brother.
Heihu doesn't yell back in anger. He delivers this cold, clear justification. It's almost like a political speech.
What does he say? What are the charges?
He lists them out. Bribery, cruelty, deceiving the court. And he specifically mentions supervising the building of the deer terrace.
The Lutai, that huge symbol of the Shang King's excess and tyranny.
Exactly. Heihu makes it clear this isn't personal hate. He says something like, I'm doing this to satisfy the people and stop our whole Chung clan from being wiped out.
Even if it means offending the ancestors, he repeats that.
He does. Public duty, clan survival, it overrides everything else in that moment. It's absolutely chilling.
And then, straight to the zoo camp.
Bound father and son, along with the captured wife and daughter, are immediately dispatched to Jiangxia for judgment. This sets up the next dramatic scene. The confrontation at the zoo headquarters.
Okay, so Heihu arrives at the zoo camp with his prisoners. How is he received?
Well, Jiangxia is thrilled. He sees this as a huge win. He praises Heihu, calls him a truly loyal gentleman, a generous hero for putting justice above family ties.
Xia sees the political value immediately. Proof that the zoo cause is so righteous, even Shang families will turn on their own wicked members.
Precisely. But then Wen Wang, the leader of the zoo, the sort of moral center of the movement, is called in.
And his reaction is different.
Very different. The text says when he sees Heihu, the man who just delivered his own brother to death, Wen Wang is visibly unhappy, displeased.
He thinks it's unrighteous, right? Even though Huhu was a villain, the act of sibling betrayal itself feels wrong to him.
That's the core tension here. Wen Wang, the future paragon of virtue, is uncomfortable with the very methods needed to achieve his righteous victory.
Which puts Xia in an interesting position.
He has to step in right away. He basically overrides Wen Wang's moral queasiness.
Mm-hmm.
Xia argues, look, Huhu was universally hated. The world wished to eat Huhu's flesh, is the phrase.
Yeah.
He says Heihu's act proves that virtue isn't limited by blood. And for their cause to succeed, justice needs to be swift, visible, and absolute. No room for sentimentality.
So Xia pushes past Wen Wang's discomfort for the sake of political necessity. What's the verdict?
Immediate execution. Xia orders Chang Huhu and his son, Chang Yingbiao, to be put to death right then and there.
Mm.
No delay, no second thoughts.
And the execution happens.
Yes, and the aftermath is stark when the severed heads are brought back to the camp.
Wen Wang's reaction.
He's horrified. The text says he was scared out of his wits. He literally uses his sleeve to hide his face from the sight.
It really underscores the human cost of Xia's ruthless pragmatism. Even the leader recoils from the necessary violence.
Definitely. But the heads are still displayed publicly at the main gate. Justice, however brutal, has been served for all to see.
So Huhu and his son are gone. What about the wife and daughter who were captured?
Bihu asks Xia what should be done with them. And this is where Xia shows a different side, maybe. A sense of calculated impartiality.
How so?
He rules that the wife, Li Shi, is innocent. She wasn't part of Huhu's crimes.
Okay, that seems fair.
And the daughter is also spared. The reasoning given is traditional. A girl marries outside the family name, meaning she won't carry the Chong clan's guilt or name forward in the same way.
So they're let go.
Yes. Xia instructs Heihu to make sure they're financially supported. It's a neat way of showing that justice wasn't just a bloodthirsty purge. It targeted the guilty. Specifically.
And what about Heihu? What's his reward for this, well, immense personal sacrifice?
He gets his political payoff. He's appointed to govern the newly conquered Chongcheng it becomes his territory.
So he saved the family line, cleansed its name in the eyes of the zoo, and gets rewarded with power.
Exactly. It consolidates zoo control over that region, and Heihu is now firmly aligned with them.
There's one last moment with Wan Wang, though, isn't there? A final check on his integrity.
Yes, it's quite telling. Heihu, now the master of Chongqing, invites Wen Wang into the city. A gesture of respect, perhaps celebration.
But Wen Wang refuses.
Flat out refuses. He says, basically, the enemy is dealt with. My job here is done. I need to go home now.
So he accepts the outcome, the political necessity of what happened.
But he won't personally participate in the, let's say, the spoils of that specific victory. He keeps that ethical distance even at the end. Wen Wang returns to his capital, Xiqi. He's just executed Cheng Huhu and his son, a guy everyone apparently hated.
Right. Politically, you'd think, job well done.
Right.
Righteous act. Liberation.
But that's not what the sources show at all. He gets home, and boom, he's hit by this sudden critical illness.
And crucially, it's not poison. It's not battle wounds. The sources link it directly to fear, to guilt.
Okay, let's unpack this then. A leader, fresh off what seems like a justified victory, basically collapses emotionally. What do the sources actually say happened to him?
Well, it's a total breakdown described in the texts. He's got this restless spirit, Shen Hun budding, deeply depressed, Yu Gulei, can't eat, can't sleep.
So definitely not celebrating.
Not even close. And it's clear this isn't just, you know, being tired from the campaign. It's presented as a crisis of conscience, a sickness of the soul, really, triggered by the execution itself.
And there's that incredibly specific detail about why he can't rest. It's not just general anxiety, is it?
No, it's graphic. The source says every time he closes his eyes, he sees the executed Cheng Huohu standing before his bed.
Wow. So he's literally haunted.
He is genuinely haunted. That single image tells you everything. It wasn't the violence itself, maybe, but the act. He fears he crossed a line.
Which brings us to the legality, right?
Yeah.
That's the heart of it. He wasn't just haunted by a ghost, but by the potential illegality of what he did.
Precisely. Remember the feudal structure. When Wang and Cheng Huohu were peers, both vassals to King Zhu, same rank.
Yeah.
By executing a fellow vassal, even a terrible one, without an explicit order from the emperor, well, he committed what the text calls Zixuan, acting independently, taking the law into his own hands.
Which in that system is a huge deal.
It's massive. It's essentially usurping the emperor's authority to judge and punish his own lords. Regardless of Cheng Huohu's crimes, Wen Wang overstepped his bounds. That's what he fears the consequences for, not just from King Zhu, but perhaps spiritually, too.
And what's so fascinating is how this internal personal crisis in Xiqi almost immediately blows up into a major political issue back in the Shang capital, Zhuozhi.
Oh, absolutely. The execution doesn't happen in a vacuum. Suddenly, the north is destabilized. Cheng Hu is gone, sure. But his brother, Cheng Huohu Black Tiger, takes over Tong City.
And he's not exactly falling in line, is he?
No, he's basically rejecting Cryoge's authority. The whole northern region is now openly defiant.
So news gets back to King Zhu. Prince Weizi delivers the report. How does the king take it?
Predictably, he's furious. But his anger is revealing. He doesn't see it as good riddance to a tyrant. He sees it as the murder of a vassal who, believe it or not, he thought had great merit. Probably because Cheng Huohu flattered him.
Great merit. Seriously.
Well, great merit in serving King Zhu. So, to the king, Wen Wang's act is pure disloyalty, Buchin, the ultimate crime against the throne.
And his reaction is immediate, right?
War. Instantly. Orders troops mobilized, attack Xiqi, attack Cheng Huohu, crush this rebellion.
Something stops it.
Yes. And this is where the internal politics of the Shang court become crucial. Minister Li Renstiusen. He manages to halt the invasion.
How do you argue against the king punishing what he sees as blatant disloyalty?
Li Ren is smart. He doesn't argue about justice or Wen Wang's reasons. He appeals directly to King Zhu's vanity and his political vulnerability, his image.
Okay, how so?
He points out that everyone knows Cheng Huohu was a monster. He poisoned the populace to Du Yuanmen, universally hated.
Right.
So Li Ren argues, if you, King Zhu, immediately rush to war to avenge this guy, you'll just prove what everyone's already whispering.
Which is?
That you favor flatterers and cronies, Cheng Bixing, that you don't care about the suffering of the people or the opinions of the other nobles, that you protect the wicked.
Wow. So attacking Wen Wang actually makes Wen Wang look right.
Exactly. It validates the moral basis for Wen Wang's potentially illegal action. If the king defends the tyrant, he basically admits he values corrupt loyalty over justice.
That's humiliating for the king. He's trapped by his own reputation.
Utterly. It shows just how much moral authority he's already lost. He can't even punish a perceived betrayal without looking even worse. The fear of confirming his image as an unjust ruler is stronger than his desire for immediate revenge.
And that delay, that PR calculation, buys Shi Qi critical time.
Desperately needed time, because back in Shi Qi, things are getting worse for Wen Wang.
His illness is progressing.
Rapidly. The sources say it becomes critical, Wai Du. He knows the end is near, so he summons his prime minister, Zhang Shangjie.
For the final instructions. This deathbed scene feels incredibly important for what comes next.
It really is. And the first thing Wen Wang does is reconfirm his guilt. He explicitly tells Jiang Shang he fears the consequences of his great crime. The Zisuan, the acting independently, he's worried about the underworld.
Still haunted by the execution right to the end.
Absolutely. And then he lays down this extraordinary final command. He makes Jiang Shang swear an oath.
What's the oath?
That they must never attack the sovereign, Yichen Fajun. Never. Even if King Zhu is the absolute worst, even if his evil, quote, fills the measure, Zhoni Guanying.
Never attack the king. But isn't that exactly what the Zhu eventually do?
That's the profound irony. When Wang's dying wish, his entire legacy as he sees it, is built on not doing that. He wants to be remembered as someone who maintained the loyalty of a subject no matter the provocation. He's terrified of the Zhu being branded regicides, subjects murdering the ruler.
So he's trying to lock the future into this path of loyalty.
He is. Then he calls in his son, his heir, Ji Fa.
To hear the mandate directly.
Yes. He tells Ji Fa, point blank, avoid reckless military action, Sixing Zhenfa. Don't risk getting that terrible name, Qin Qun Jiming, subject murdering the ruler.
And he gives Jifa specific instructions for ruling.
Three key things. First, Jifa must formally bow to Jiangshang and accept him as Yangfu. It means like second father or foster father. It's a huge elevation of Jiangshang's status and authority.
Okay, so cementing Jiangshang's role, what else?
Second, he hammers home the point about duty. Always act as a loyal subject, Kishuki Zi, don't overstep, don't get condemned by history.
And the third?
Three principles for good governance. See good without tiring, act righteously without doubt, and avoid wrongdoing.
These are the words of a statesman trying to preserve order, not a revolutionary leader.
Precisely. Then he laments, you know, not having more time to advise King Zhu or finish his work on the eight trigrams, and then he dies. Hong. At age 97, his legacy as he intended it was Zhongshou Renxinji. Ultimately maintain the fidelity of a benevolent subject.
Which leads us straight into this massive contradiction. When Wang dies, forbidding rebellion with his last breath. So Jifa takes over. What's the first thing that happens? Does that oath hold?
Well, strategically, not for long. Jifa becomes the new Western ruler. He immediately follows the first instruction. He honors Jiang Shang, calling him Sheng Fu, esteemed father. So, check.
And they start implementing Wen Wang's governance style.
Yes, the virtue-based governance continues. And the effect, according to the sources, is immediate and powerful.
Oh, so?
All 200 feudal lords, Su Hu, they all submit to the new regime in Shi Qi, voluntarily.
200 lords. That's basically everyone who matters.
It's overwhelming support. It shows the Zhu's moral authority was immense. The lords were effectively choosing Shi Qi's virtue over Shao's corruption.
Okay, massive political win, but here's the pivot, isn't it? The big strategic break from Wen Wang's final wish.
This is it. When Wang died fearing the label of subject murdering ruler, Jifa takes power, consolidates his huge base of support, and then he's proclaimed King Wu.
King Wu, not Duke Wu or Marquise Wu.
King Wu.
Wang. Wu means martial or military. By taking the title King, Jifa is implicitly publicly claiming sovereignty. He's saying the mandate of heaven, demonstrated by the support of the people and the lords, now rests with him. Not necessarily with the Shang Emperor.
So he's honoring his father's governance model, the jettisoning the core prohibition against challenging the ultimate authority. In effect, yes, he's saying, my father was loyal, but the situation is now so bad, a higher authority, the mandate compels me to step up as king. It's a brilliant, necessary compromise, perhaps.
But even with this moral high ground and widespread support, the Shang system isn't quite dead yet, right? News travels.
Exactly. The wheels are still turning, however slowly and rustily, in Cherish. General Han Rong, down at Sishu Pass, hears about Wen Wang's death, and he hears about Ji Fa proclaiming himself King Wu.
That's the undeniable evidence of rebellion there.
Oh, yeah, that's the smoking gun.
Yeah.
Han Rong sends a formal report to the capital.
And we get one last glimpse into the dysfunction at the Shang court. How do they handle this news?
It's almost darkly comedic. Advisor Yao Zong gets the report. He knows what it means. He says, "We have to tell the king immediately. This is clear rebellion. Duty calls."
Makes sense.
But Prince Weizi steps in, and he's just deeply cynical at this point. He basically says, "What's the point? The idiot ruler, Hun Jun, won't care. He'll ignore it, dismiss it as nothing, and go back to his pleasures."
Wow. Even the king's own family knows he's beyond reach.
It shows the utter paralysis. Weizi knows the king is incompetent, but Yao Zong feels bound by his duty as a subject, Gijin Chenje. Each fulfill the duty of a subject, even if it's pointless.
So duty wins out over cynicism.
Yao Zong insists. He reports the news, he does his duty, even knowing it might fall on deaf ears initially. But that act, reporting the new King Wu, officially sets the stage for the final conflict. The inevitable clash is now formally on the table.